You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
The Pet Doctor is brought to you by Dog.com. For everything and anything dog, shop Dog.com today for all the top brands. Greenies, Frontline, Kong, Nylabone, Royal Canin, and more. Shop at Dog.com and use the promo code SADDOC, S-A-D-D-O-C, and get $15 off your order of $75 or more.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
One of the most common orthopedic procedures presently being performed on America's aging population is a knee replacement. Man's best friend is also plagued with stifled knee issues. Dr. Randy Fitch, a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Surgeons, will discuss why dogs have knee problems, what can be done to prevent them, and how to treat them and get your dog back to peak performance after its injury. We'll be right back after the short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Love your pets but wish their medications were a lot less expensive? They are at 1-800-PetMeds. You'll not only save on flea and heartworm medications, but on prescriptions for arthritis, incontinence, thyroid, and more. And you get fast service, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Plus, our licensed pharmacists ensure accuracy, monitor drug interaction, and more. See why over 5 million people have trusted their pet's health to 1-800-PetMeds, America's largest pet pharmacy. Call now or order online.
Go to PetMeds.com/doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, to get 10% off any order and free shipping on orders of $39 or more at PetMeds.com.
FTD's network of over 40,000 florists around the world have been creating beautiful handcrafted arrangements for 100 years. Each arrangement is delivered the same day and backed by FTD's 7-day satisfaction guarantee. For a century, people have trusted their most important occasions to the flower experts at FTD.
Since Pet Life Radio is all about puppy dogs and flowers, our listeners, that's you, can get a 20% discount on your order. Just go to florop.com and use the code DR20 at checkout. FLEUROP.com, code word DOCTOR, and the number 20.
How would you like your business to reach out and invite in our audience?
We have a brand new trademark concept called InfoSeeds.
InfoSeeds are short 20-second seeds of information about your place of business, practice, or service.
We only have a limited number of slots left. For more information, visit PetLifeRadio.com. Click on sponsorship information.
There you can listen to a sample of InfoSeed or email us at
PetLifeRadio.com.
Remember, only a limited number of opportunities are available.
This year, Americans are expected to spend a jaw-dropping $36 billion on their pets. From lighted leashes to high-end spa products, the discriminating pet owner can find just about anything to pamper his or her pet. Hi, this is Michelle Fern. Join me every week for Best Bets for Pets, where we'll talk about the latest pet products and talk to the companies that make them. Best Bets for Pets. Every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Fitch, is this really that common of a problem?
You know, it's pretty amazing. Although these dogs are actually much better equipped for jogging, ambulation, and motion than we are, and you'd assume that they would have less instances of injury, that's not necessarily true. In fact, if you look at the prevalence of injury in people, you know, one of the most common things that we think about is ACL injuries or knee injuries.
So that's kind of like that football injury, correct?
That's correct, yeah. And you would think that that would be true for dogs. And so as we start to look at it, it's kind of interesting. So a couple surprising results. One thing, as you start to look at the way the dog is put together, is, you know, we have these crazy legs ourselves. You know, we are on two legs as people, and our legs are straight, and we're standing on our heels, and we're more made for probably climbing trees than walking and jogging. And these dogs, you know, our four-legged friends, they actually, you know, they're on four legs, so they distribute weight between four legs, and actually most of the weight's on their front legs. And yet, in a prevalence study, we actually found that the prevalence of cruciate disease is higher in the dog than it is in people, which makes no sense. So they have 40% of the weight bearings on their back legs. In fact, they're built completely different. They can't even hyperextend their knee. In us, you know, we have these straight legs. We can come down on it. We can blood or collateral ligaments, all these different ligaments around their knees. And the dogs, they have a bent leg. They don't come down on them. They come down on their front legs. So we really shouldn't see hardly any cruciate injuries, yet we do. So that's the enigma.
I know you've done a tremendous amount of research, and it's not that you're a board-certified surgeon, but you also have done lots of research, so you're going into the pathology of it and why. Have you found a reason as to why? Because you're saying, yeah, they have all their weight, but they carry so much of their weight in the front legs.
Yes, yeah, so the question is, why is this occurring? So they don't have the same forces. That means their mechanism of injury has to be different from people. And yet, you know, we've been relying on human research over, decades. I mean, we do a lot of research, and as we look at that, we kept thinking they have the same mechanism. Well, the mechanism actually is quite different. And as you mentioned, I used to do a lot of research, and a lot of my research was in very specific areas of the knee in the dog. And so I was looking at intercostal fossa, very specific regional areas. My master's was 300 pages in this little bitty area of the knee. And yet, the real answer to this is not in the knee at all. It's actually down in the ankle. And that's where it's fascinating.
An ankle problem is causing a knee issue. Why so?
Yes. So maybe not a problem necessarily. Maybe just the way that they're built. Is right now, if you're standing there listening to this as a person, your heel's on the ground. Now, if you look at your dog and look where their heel is, and you notice that their heel's in the air. And what's attached to your heel is actually your Achilles mechanism, which originates from the back of the femur. So for us, I'm standing here with my heels on the ground, and my dog next to me, his heels are in the air, and his Achilles mechanism is under tension. And what that's doing is pulling the back of the femur and trying to actually dislocate the knee. So they have all this extra stress on their knee that we don't have because of the way we stand. So we stand completely different from our dogs.
And they're standing basically on their toes.
So they're standing on their toes, exactly right. So they're standing on their toes. And what that means is now they have, because of that, they have all this force that's induced into their knee. And it's what it's trying to do is trying to push the tibia forward and putting extra stress on their cruciate ligament. So what's really fascinating, so how does this affect us? And one way to really evaluate this is let's look at treatments. We've been borrowing from human surgery for some time, trying to recreate exactly what they do, trying to fix this injury. And if we do the exact same surgery that is successful in people, it fails in the dog. If we use that inner articular reconstruction, they don't hold up well. So what's different? And so one of the fascinating parts about this is in the dog, if we put that same construct, that same repair of their ligament in their knee, it's under continual stress, and it over time just falls apart again. So the injury in the dog is probably quite different than people. And in fact, it's probably a combination, not just of injury in their architecture and the way that their leg's built.
I think one of the things that I need to stop you right now, oftentimes clients will be in an exam room with me and I'm playing with the knees and they go, is that the front legs or the back legs where the knee is located? And just for people to put in their heads, if you're a person and all of a sudden you get down on four legs, just like your pet is, the knees are the ones in the back. And I know this is very rudimentary, but just want to make sure people realize the legs in the back, just like us, you have your dog stand up on its rear legs. Those are the knees in the back. That's where you're talking about, where they're having problems. So Dr. Fitch, do you think this is kind of a matter of nature versus nurture. One of my clients is a breeder of little Yorkies. And she says whenever she has a pup that she now sells, she'll always tell the people not to let that little puppy go up and down stairs and don't let it stand up on its rear legs until it's like 9-10 months of age, because she feels as though this is going to cause knee issues later on. Is she just being a breeder, or is there any reality to her views?
Breeder versus reality. I love that. Well, here's what I can tell you is there's no evidence that supports that. And the reason I can say that is most of the cruciate ligament injuries that we see actually occur a little bit later in age. It is breed specific, in that I mean that certain breeds have a higher incidence. And we all kind of know that common sense. And when we start to look at that, is the Rottweiler is probably one of the dogs that gets the earlier prevalence of cruciate injury. And most of their cruciate injuries actually occur before 4 years of age, but still, that's an adult dog. So immature development of cruciate injuries occurs, but is not common. The other thing that it's sort of interesting how this impacts us too at the same time is what it means for treatment. And so when we're looking at architecture and injuries, if you think about the concept of this in us is, in humans, we have an injured ligament. Let's repair that. In the dog, if we do exactly that, like we explained earlier, it doesn't necessarily work. What was the big paradigm shift in this was changing the actual architecture of the knee. And that's these newer procedures in which they actually make cuts in bones, they realign the bones to produce actually a knee that doesn't need a cruciate ligament. That load's completely different. And that's the triple pelvic osteotomy, the tibial tuberal, the tibial tuberosity advancement, some of these newer procedures, and actually there's an array of different tibial osteotomies or cuts in the tibia bone that realign the knee itself. And that was a big shift in our way of thinking.
When you're doing these procedures, are you always waiting until there's an injury before you do it, or can you preemptively do a surgical procedure? There are sometimes a pet will come in talking about knees, and they will have trick knees, where a patella, that kneecap that's popping in and out of joint. And I've been taught that it's supposed to be graded 1 through 4. 1's a little wiggle. 4 is when that kneecap is not sitting in the groove that it's supposed to. And I tell people that it's causing abnormal stresses and strains, but they say, hey, it's not causing any problems. It's not lame. Do we approach it at that time or wait till there's a problem?
Yeah, for us as investigators, a couple thoughts come through to mind with that in that regard. Is number one is we have to have a condition that we know most commonly leads to degeneration. And one of the places that occurs is hip dysplasia. And so we know if they have in their hips, if they have subluxation or real loose hips, that predisposes that hip to degenerating. And that's a situation in which if we have the reasonable intervention, it would make some sense to go ahead and correct that alignment. And the same is true for the patella, and I think that's a good example, is if we know that they already have some malalignment of that patella, will it degenerate? And there's some evidence to show that people have arthritis. And the question is, how much does it clinically impact them? And in certain situations, it makes sense to go ahead and preemptively intervene. But you always have to weigh that with other factors in the patient, too, as what's their general health.
So if a pet is not having clinical signs, may just be able to watch it, what would people be looking for to realize that their pet may be having some issues with the knees, with the stifles?
Now, that's a fantastic question, because that's really probably the question I should have answered before, is most of the time when I do get that question in the exam room, I said, my dog doesn't have clinical signs. And in a lot of those cases, they do have clinical signs. So I think that's really relevant. They're just really good athletes, and they're really good at masking their pathology or their degeneration and arthritis. So for the knee, for example, one thing you should look for is abnormal sitting, in that they sit asymmetrically and they're uncomfortable. So conditions that we typically see this is, cruciates are really common when they sneak up on people. They have a partial tear that propagates. It starts as a small tear, usually a small lameness that then resolves. But if you really start to look at their gait, you'll see a sachet in their gait. You'll see that they're compensating. You'll see that they are transferring weight to their front legs, and they're adapting, but they're actually injured, and so they're very good at hiding their limp.
Oftentimes people will say, well, yeah, it had a little bit of a lameness, but I just thought it was a sprained ankle, or it stubbed its toe, or it did whatever, and it went away in a couple days. So, yeah, I didn't really even concentrate on that. And, oh, yeah, it just kind of sits there like a lazy dog, throws a leg out. But those are all signs that they shouldn't ignore. That may be something.
Absolutely, they shouldn't ignore that. The other, you know, we learn a lot from our agility dogs, because they're asked to perform and they're being timed, and they're actually having that type of functional analysis that sometimes the rest of us don't pay as much attention to. And so when you start to watch them, is if they have just a minor injury, it will really throw off their times, their agility, their coordination, and so they can be pretty severely affected. And for a lot of us, it can be hard to pick up and really observe those changes. Lumbosacral disease is another one of those that sneaks up on people, which can be pretty severe. And that is lower back pain, just like in us. And they're good at masking it, but dogs really, really suffer from lumbosacral stenosis or lumbosacral pain or lower back pain. They have difficulty jumping. They have difficulty extending up. And if you put them in a performance arena, they will have difficulty jumping over obstacles.
If you believe that your pet, okay, it's sashaying now, and it's not just a cute little walk, it has a funky little sachet in its walk, and it's sitting uncomfortably, leg out to the side, that's a pet that sometimes, you know, if that owner that is very concerned brings it in, I'll take a look, I'll try and feel the leg and the knee, and nothing really seems swollen. What do we do there? Because clinically, gee, it seems pretty good. You and I might have an MRI done. What do I recommend for the pet owner?
The big expansions in our diagnostics has been pretty impressive. We don't necessarily have to go right to MRI right away. It's nice to have that available for some complex conditions. Our approach to orthopedics is interesting. It's basically an evaluation of how well our mobility and how we ambulate. And so we actually do a bunch of functional tests just like your physiotherapist would. The other things that will depend on quite a bit is such things as arthroscopy. And arthroscopy has been a big boom to our understanding of disease in the dog, just as it was in human orthopedics in the last 30 years in human orthopedics, you've seen this huge explosion of arthroscopy and some of the understanding of joint injury from that. Same thing's happening for us as it occurred a little bit later. It's really opened our eyes. Some conditions that we were taught, like you and I in vet school, we were taught that a lot of these dogs had, let's say, biceps tendinitis, which is a biceps inflammation in the shoulder. And we're given this test that we're supposed to do, and that's supposed to be correlated with those dogs, but we never confirmed it. So there's a study done about 10 years ago, and in which they took a lot of these dogs that were positive for this test that you and I were taught in vet school to do, and we actually put a scope in their shoulder and determine, well, do they have this condition? And in 52 joints, they had hardly any dogs that actually had biceps tendinitis. So their biceps tendon was not injured, and those dogs are positive for that classic exam. In fact, most of them had other conditions, collateral ligament injuries, cartilage damage, supraspinatus injuries, infraspinatus, and subscapular type things. Anyway, things that are recognized in the joint itself. So it really opened our eyes to all these different injuries, and they have different treatments. So they're not treated the same. So we probably treat a lot of those dogs inappropriately. So if we don't have that available, that really opens your eyes. You know, there's another study looking at arthroscopy, kind of interesting. And this affects all of us, even if we don't have arthroscopies. They're looking at how well were we able to identify the source of the lameness in the dog. This came out of the University of Missouri.
And that can be so hard. I'll have somebody come and say, well, which leg? Ooh, well, it's one of the ones in the back. Because sometimes just even watching them walk, as you're saying, they are so good at hiding those signs of illness and there's the lameness problem. I'll look and I have a very hard time of watching which leg are they favoring. What should a pet owner be looking for? Is it not carrying weight on that leg? Is it a head bob? What should they be seeing?
The dogs are really effective at compensating and hiding their lameness. And so here's what they're going to do is if they have a lameness, let's say it's on a hind leg, is they're going to shift weights off of that, and they're going to shift it onto the other three legs. Now, with this compensation, they're going to do other things that's going to help them offload the weight on that leg and take away the pain. And a couple things they'll do is lots of times they'll change the motion of that knee, which can be hard to detect. But the biggest thing that you'll see a lot of these dogs is weight shifting. So if we shift off a leg or off both back legs, you'll start to see some really good examples of these dogs that are basically walking on their front legs and have very little weight on their back legs. They'll also have some changes in their joint angles. You know, here's a really cool little trick, is look at their toes, and you see if they're shifting weight off. If they're placing a lot of weight on their leg, they'll actually splay their toes. And if they're not, you'll start to see those toes will start to raise up, and you compare it to the other toes. That's a really good trick. And what they used to do in the old days is they used to put some type of powder down, and it'd be sort of like the dog walking through snow, is you'd actually look at the track patterns of the feet. Now, they do that today in a more sophisticated way, either with a force plate analysis, some type of platform that they can walk the dogs, but it's the same concept. It's like walking through fresh snow.
And right now, it being so snowy throughout the United States, if you're in doubt, take your dog outside and watch it walk on snow, or if you maybe even try a little sand. That's a good way to do it. And as they're wearing their nails, would you notice that the nails are being worn differently also?
That's a great comment. That's something we'll look for. It can indicate either orthopedic disease, so injuries of muscle and tendon and bones, or neurologic disease, so injuries that affect the spinal cord. Typically, and so we'll look for both those to see if they're having changes in the motion of their legs, if they're scraping their toes, or in a toe injury that they're abnormally wearing their nails on one side of their foot more.
Well, I don't want to stifle this conversation, but we do need to take a short break for a commercial. We'll be right back and learn more about orthopedic issues and knees in dogs from Dr. Randy Fitch. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
At Petco, we really love pets. There isn't anything we won't do to make sure they're getting the best products and the best care. So when you ask us a question like,
"So how do you feel about cat condos?"
we can say from experience,
"Feels like home for her."
Enter the code DOCTOR10, DOCTOR, the number 10, and get 10% off any order. No minimum at Petco.com.
There's a movement afoot. ShoeBuy.com. Join the millions of people who shop ShoeBuy.com's over 400 brands and 500,000 products. Order now and get free shipping and free return shipping. ShoeBuy.com, the world's greatest shoe store.
Walk your dog in style and comfort. Enter the code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R, at checkout and get a 10% discount plus free shipping at ShoeBuy.com.
Hi, I'm Angelina. Join me for some great training tips to live a happy, healthy, peaceful life together with your best friend. And by the way, they're not the only ones that learn something new. Join me for Teacher's Pet on Pet Life Radio.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets
on Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
So, Dr. Fitch, you're talking about arthroscopy, and arthroscopy being using very small little cameras, basically, to look into a joint. Now, can you look into cat joints? We've been talking about dogs, but kitty joints are so teeny. What's the smallest that you can look into?
That used to be our excuse, is the reason we couldn't do arthroscopy in a dog is because their joints are too small, and then, of course, the human orthopedist started putting them in our little inner phalangeal joints, which are a lot smaller than what we work with in the dog, and so that excuse was fell apart pretty quickly.
And phalanges are fingers.
Yes, in between our little finger joints, and right in between our little carpal or hand joints. They can actually go in and find a little chip. So we don't have that excuse anymore. And we started actually doing a lot of arthroscopy about 10 to 15 years ago in our industry. We commonly put small scopes into joints of, let's say, the elbow of a very small dog or a cat, and that's not difficult. These scopes are pencil thin. In fact, they're smaller than a pencil. We have a 1.9 millimeter scope. The outside diameter of the scope is less than 2 millimeters. So you can imagine it's like almost like putting in a needle, a little bit bigger than that, a needle into the joint. And it's a periscope, so you can look around and evaluate the whole joint. And that's really been a huge revolution in our way of being able to evaluate these patients.
That is absolutely teeny. That's wondrous. This doesn't sound like it's going to be an inexpensive proposition, however.
That's true. You pay for the technology. Less invasive techniques are usually not less invasive to your pocketbook. That's the price we pay.
I'm sure people, when they see the price tag, you know, gasp and say, but, you know, it doesn't cost that much, doc, for me to have it done. And that's because we have our health insurance one way or the other. Other than using something like the scope, you'd mentioned, yes, there's MRI. What else can be done to see what's going on with the joint?
One of the common techniques we do is a joint tap. So we just place a simple needle into the joint, and we withdraw the fluid and evaluate that fluid. That's very helpful. We can do multiple joints at once, just like arthroscopy. You know, one of the advantages of arthroscopy, again, is I've done up to 4 joints in the same patient. And with old techniques, the open surgical techniques, you couldn't do that. And coming back to that cost argument with that, too, is the other question is, if you were doing 4 joints and you were doing them separate in the old technique, it costs a lot more staging those or doing them at separate events than doing them all at once. So sometimes there actually can be quite a cost savings with arthroscopy. Other ways to evaluate these joints is, I mean, joint tap are very inexpensive. And what we do is we put a little needle in here. We have to shave the leg, of course, and you have to thoroughly prep it. But you put a needle, just like you're aspirating a mass, into the joint itself and withdraw that fluid. That can tell us if there's inflammation in the joint, if there's hemorrhage in the joint, or if there's infection in the joint.
And if you're seeing blood or evidence of infection, typically putting them on antibiotics, everything will be better when you're done?
So the arthroscopy helps. You always have to fold the arthroscopy find, or the, I'm sorry, the arthrocentesis or the joint tap finds in with the whole workup. So reasons for blood in the joint could be rodenticide. They could be hemophilia A. They could be a systemic disease. If we have a dog who doesn't have any other signs of hemorrhage in the body and it's had trauma, we'd be thinking of something more traumatic. If this is a dog that had fluid that was very opaque and had extra fluid in there and had a lot of distal limb swelling, that would lead us to think more of maybe a septic or infected arthritis. If we had a cruciate dog, a dog that has cruciate instability, they'd have excessive fluid and some minor changes to that fluid. They'd be inflamed, but not to that severity. If we had a dog that had a immune-mediated disease, it can be very opaque and it'll involve multiple joints. And again, this is where the veterinarian is really important in this, is joint taps by themselves aren't very meaningful. You have to look in the context of the patient and your veterinarian's knowledge base.
So we've now diagnosed that the pet is having an issue with the knee. Maybe it has torn the cruciate ligament. With that type of diagnosis, now you just won the lottery. Money's not a concern. What do you do for my dog, Dr. Fitch?
For a dog with a cranial cruciate rupture, really, it's came to the standard. I came from the field of doing lots of research, but when it comes to patient care and being a patient advocate, I like to be a little bit more conservative in what we recommend. I like proven techniques and not necessarily the latest techniques. I don't want a track record with those techniques. And the technique right now that has a pretty big track record and the biggest endorsement are typically tibial plateau leveling osteotomy. And so that's one of the procedures in which we cut the tibia and we rotate. This is also true for the TTA. I'm more aligned with the TPLO, but I would say there's a lot of evidence with the TTA that you could also do that procedure. To kind of give you an idea, what I'd go is I'd go in with an arthroscope. I would evaluate the joint, evaluate the meniscus, any other damage, and then following that, we would do this surgical procedure. And what we have, in particular with that, is we have a lot of evidence with the TPLO that we have good long-term outcomes. and a lot of personal experience that we have good long-term outcomes. And that's why, in particular, I like that procedure.
So the TPLO, the tibia being the lower leg bone, the bigger bone towards the middle of your leg, for those people who are just kind of, what bone are they talking about? All right, I didn't win the lottery. I don't have lots of money. I would love to take care of this for my dog. I can't. Now what do I do?
So if surgery is not an option, in certain conditions like hip dysplasia, it's surprising how well the dogs will adapt. Not that they don't suffer from arthritis in their hips, but they can adapt well. The knee in particular is one of those joints that doesn't adapt well. And it's because of that particular loading in that they basically dislocate their knee as they walk. So in the dog, in my experience, I think they all benefit from surgery. And so we'll be looking at some type of surgical alternative. Now, if that's not an option for you, then what else helps with compensation? Well, the bigger you are, the less you're able to compensate. So for small dogs, dogs less than 30 pounds, a lot of those dogs can adapt and live pretty good quality of life with conservative treatment. I'm not saying they're comparably better than TPLO or extracap or some one of these surgical procedures, but they can adapt and do pretty well. And there's an old study by Dr. Vester some time ago that looked at that, and they said they found that they had pretty good outcomes. So it leaves you an option for those smaller dogs that if they really can't do the best possible procedure for the dog, is you can have reasonable outcomes. Now, in the bigger dogs, I tend to see that they really, really struggle. And they start to have a lot of problems, especially if both legs end up having knee injuries, and then they start to have lower back pain, and they really do suffer without surgery.
But doc, boy, I'd love to do it. I still can't afford it. What are my options?
So the options for conservative treatment in the knee are going to consist mostly of not anti-inflammatory, so non-steroidals, let's say Rimadyl, Duramax, Privacox, one of the doggy aspirin type drugs. You have to be careful with those. You can't mix them with each other. Can't mix them with aspirin. Those will take away some of the discomfort. They won't take away the mechanical instability. That can be helpful. We can use some joint supplements that can help a little bit with joint erosion. And one other thing that can be really helpful, let's say if I had a dog that was, let's say it was a 13 and really had some other issues and we didn't want to put that dog under anesthesia for its other health issues, is that gives me two options then. If I want to assist that dog in some way, one way that I'll achieve that is I'll put a harness on that dog and that we can help support them, and especially during difficult transitions on slick surfaces, stairs, that they have a handle on their back that we can help them in those situations, get them moving every day and try to keep their muscle tone as good as possible. The other option is putting on braces. Now, there are a few braces that work pretty well out there, but most of them, in my experience, have not worked out very well. So we have to really look at those braces, and also they're difficult to put on. Compliance isn't very good. So I found that the braces, except for in very specific situations, are not as useful as we'd hoped.
One of the things that I'll always look for when clients come in, and you know, even if we are going to be going to surgery, if I have some time, is tell them to lose weight if their pet's overweight, because just you're talking about loading that joint, that extra weight puts so much load on the joint. And we also know that fat, especially intra-abdominal fat, produces a tremendous number of chemicals, a lot of those that are pro-inflammatory, causing inflammation. And I love that you said, yes, aspirin-like, but we definitely don't want to give aspirin to a dog. What's your view about using some of the artificial joint-type fluids like adequate injections?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention, too, is you mentioned back to the body scores or the weight of the dog as far as is what is their body score, or what type of shape are they in. And really coming back to that one more time is the University of Pennsylvania study in which they looked at Labradors. Now, this is a study in which they looked at Labradors that had hip dysplasia and they had siblings. So they had two dogs from the same litter, and assuming that they had similar disease in their hips, in one set of dogs, they fed them ad lib as much as they want, and the other, they reduced that caloric intake to try to keep it more reasonable. Initially, what they found was they both got overweight because they're Labradors and on this earth to eat. So they had to actually reduce them both. But so they had two different groups, and they're trying to produce two different body scores, and they did. And so these are dogs that are orthopedically compromised. They have hip dysplasia. Here's the fascinating part. Those dogs lived to be the overweight dogs lived 2 years less than the dogs of normal body score, meaning that the overweight dogs had shortened their lifespan by 2 years. And 68% of those dogs are actually euthanized because their quality of life degraded because of orthopedic or lameness issues. So back to your point about body score and how it impacts orthopedic disease, it really magnifies orthopedic disease. So it's one of the best things we can do in our overweight dogs is try to find a way to get those dogs into a more healthy body score and a more healthy lifestyle. The joint supplements themselves, we've been using them for 20 years plus. And what we're mostly concerning with those is chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine, which have certainly been shown in some models like collagen erosion models to really help with collagen resurfacing. Certainly anecdotally, we have those cases in which we know that the owners feel the dogs have benefits. It's a hard thing to prove, though, and it's going to be a mainstay of what we do. But I think we get a lot of endorsement from our clients who have felt that they've had a lot of benefit from those. But those are some of the concerns. The same thing's true for Adequan. Is there's a lot of information out there that Adequan can be very beneficial. It's kind of an older drug and kind of fell out of the limelight for a while. But it still has its role, especially in certain types of arthritis, let's say elbow arthritis, which is a joint that's really constrained by bone and has very little tolerance for arthritis. It can be beneficial in those type of diseases.
And how about stem cell therapy? Stem cells oftentimes now, and people hear that term get a little bit concerned, not being embryonic stem cells, but actually harvesting fat from a dog, a cat, horses, they use it a lot, concentrating the stem cells that are there, these progenitor cells, and then re-injecting it back into a joint or even intravenously. What are your views on stem cell therapy for leg orthopedic issues?
Isn't stem cell therapy, it's a really fascinating area. And there's two different types of stem cells that we can use in the dog. We can use fat-derived or we can use stem cells derived from bone marrow. And a little bit of debate out there between those two, and that's one area that you'll see a little bit of debate on which is the best source, which has the most pleural potential, or which has the greatest ability to adapt and do the types of things that we want to have occur in the joint. Now, they have a few studies out there, and they've been clinical evaluations, and they've used multiple parameters in trying to evaluate that, and they use a placebo control. And so in these patients, what they did is they tried to find a dog population like with hip dysplasia or elbow dysplasia that had a consistent population, and then treat those and see if they see any benefit over a placebo. Now, the fat in these studies that I'm talking about specifically was adipose-derived, and basically what you do is a very quick little surgery where they harvest fat from the abdominal cavity typically, but that's not the only region. And then that fat is then sent in and then after you harvest it, it's refined, and then the stem cells are returned to you, depending on which company you're using, and that's injected into the joint. The evidence in that clinical study was pretty encouraging. It's still early on this, but it's pretty darn encouraging in that those dogs did show marked improvement. In fact, anecdotally, there's a couple of those dogs that really showed some marked improvement. And it's not necessarily working the way that we all intended. There's the anti-inflammatory effect, not always as much cartilage regeneration as once believed, although, you know, that research is still being done too, so we're still early on this, but it's encouraging at this time.
Dr. Fitch, quick little wrap up. I started this whole conversation with joint replacements are being so common in people. What is the chance of someday there being a joint replacement for dogs in their knees?
So in regards to joint replacements, now, joint replacements in the dog have been done since the 1950s. In fact, if you look through the history of total hip replacement, you know, veterinarians have been some of the leaders in some of the technology for total hip replacement. We all benefit from some of the work that veterinarians have done before us. some of the biggest breakthroughs at that time in the evolution of hip replacement that we probably all gained or have relatives have gained a lot of benefit from was due to those veterinarians and the dogs.
So this is another example of this One World, One Health, One Medicine initiative, that human medicine helping veterinarian and vice versa. So we've done the hips. How about knees and elbows?
So the hip, we know something about. The elbow, you know, elbow replacements have been done for about 10 years at this point with success, but with a little bit more limited success, and there's still some difficulties with that. There is Mike Hyphemius, who's now at the University of Minnesota, but was at Iowa State University before that, was one of the pioneers in trying to develop elbow replacement. Was very forthright about what was funny, and says sometimes it worked fantastic, but they did have their disasters with those elbows too, especially during that period. We're at a period that we're improving with elbow replacement, but we're still having some difficulties at the same time. So we need to be aware that we don't have all the complications worked out in the elbow. The knee itself, in fact, I was just talking with one of the vets who that performs a lot of knee replacement at Gulf Coast, and he's become much more encouraged. He started very conservative, like he should have, but he's become very comfortable with knee replacements in dogs and feels he has a very high success. Initially, he started off with those disaster dogs that there were no, or disaster knees in which there were no other alternatives. Because the knee itself is pretty complex. So a couple things you have to consider is, what if it fails? That's what most vets are going to consider first. If a hip fails, we can remove the hip replacement and you have pretty good function. The knee is has a little bit more jeopardy with it. And so that's when Dr. Liska was first looking at it, one of his concerns is, boy, this better work. Through his development, he's gained a lot more confidence in this and becoming more aggressive with the type of cannons that would fit for that replacement. So there's a lot of progress being made in knee replacement in dogs at this time.
Well, Dr. Fitch, you have given us some awesome information, things that I've learned also, so I always appreciate it. Hopefully the listeners have learned a little bit more about knees, hips, joints in general. If you ever have questions about your own pets, the best person to ask is always going to be your primary care veterinarian, but you can drop me a line at the pet doctor at Pet Life Radio, and I'll try to answer them for you as best I can. Dr. Fitch, thank you so much for being with us. Mark, thank you for doing an awesome job of editing this. And if you want to know more about pets in general, make sure you always go to Pet Life Radio. There's a multitude of various podcasts that you can listen to. So again, Dr. Fitch, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Listen again next week. We'll have more information on making you the best pet owner that you can possibly be. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.